BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is the Word of Mouth podcast and I'm Michael Rosen. On Word of Mouth, we talk about words and language and the weird and wonderful ways we're using them right now. There's an interesting video I've seen online from the charity Made by Dyslexia. This aims to challenge the idea that having dyslexia is a disadvantage. In fact, they set up a fake dyslexic sperm bank to see how people felt about having a dyslexic baby. And I think it's safe to say that most of the people they talk to do not react well to the idea at first. Well, it started us thinking about dyslexia and language. So on today's Word of Mouth, I'm pleased to say that I'm joined by Professor Maggie Snowling, CBE, President of St John's College, Oxford, and a leading expert on dyslexia. Maggie, what is dyslexia?
Put very simply, dyslexia is a difficulty in learning to read and to spell and to do so fluently, but it's a lifelong and persistent condition which really affects educational attainment.
Now, you said difficulty there, but in a way, many of us have difficulty. I mean, I'm pretty fluent, but every now and then I have difficulty. So what would distinguish somebody who has a bit of difficulty and dyslexia?
Well, I would suggest you didn't have difficulty learning to read. And so the first thing is it's a difficulty of learning. And one of the ways in which we can pick it up, actually, is the fact that a child doesn't really respond to being taught to learn to read. The other thing I would say is it's characterised in terms of severity. And then there are a number of other associated features which tend to go along with dyslexia. And these are in the domain of language, particularly the part of language that's specialised for processing speech.
Right. So not like the process of writing. The reason why I say that is I do a lot of work in schools, and something I'm familiar with is, okay, how shall I describe this? A kind of clever kid who stereotypically, and I'll admit to that, I might expect to write fluently and correctly in standard English. And then I look at the page of writing and there's a lot of jumbled letters and I'm thinking, oh, that's interesting. Is that because of me thinking, having the stereotypic views? And one feature of this is that the letters don't correspond with the sounds that you'd expect. So let's say there's the word bird and the child has written something like drib. And it's not the same order of mistake as, say, if they wrote bird spelled B-E-R-D, which does, in phonic terms, spell the word bird, but it's the wrong way. So I think, well, I can't read that as bird, but then I find the child can. So have I described a form of dyslexia there?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that, I mean, you call it stereotypical, and there's actually quite a lot of different sorts of errors that children with dyslexia will make. But your observation about these muddled letters leads a lot of people to think that this is some kind of visual problem. In actual fact, the problem that the child has is sorting out the sound sequence of the word. Because in order to learn to read, what we have to do at a fine-grained level is we have to understand how the speech sounds of words link to the letters of printed words. So if you take a simple word like cat, we have to know that that splits into k-at and that those sounds link to the letters. What the child who jumbles up letters is doing is not understanding the sound sequence, but they might make other errors too. So they might, instead of the k, write g, for example, or instead of the t, write d. So there are quite a lot of different sorts of errors that can stem from this really basic problem in linking the speech sounds with the letters.
So how do you know which bit, which end of that process? Because we've got, you've said there, there's the phonological, the hearing side of it, and then there's the graphic side of it, the letters. I believe that's called the phoneme-grapheme correspondence.
That's right,
yes. How do you know whether the child is, as it were, jumbling those sounds of cat to make cat and they're perhaps hearing it as tack or act or whatever, or the fact that on paper that C-A-T thing doesn't make sense? How do you know which end of the business it is?
Well, there's lots of different converging evidence, I think, that would lead us to that theory. First of all, for many years, people did think dyslexia was a visual problem. And then they found that actually, if you asked children with dyslexia to remember sequences of, say, visual strings of symbols or perhaps a foreign orthography that they don't know, like Hebrew, they're actually just as well as their normal reading peers.
Ah, that's so crucial,
isn't it? That kind of rules out the visual thing.
So the graphic end, they're okay with,
yes,
more often than not, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
Whereas the phonological end, even in an adult with dyslexia, they'll still have some problems in processing speech sounds that might be to do with, if you ask them to take a word like, I don't know, skip, take away the k sip, but you can do it all in the verbal modality and they would still have difficulties. The other sorts of evidence we have is if we look at kids who have been studied through time from preschool through to school age who are at high risk of dyslexia, and then we look at the ones who become dyslexic at around about age 8 and we can look back in time to see what their language development was like, we'll see very early on they've got problems with these phonological skills rather than the visual skills. So there's a lot of converging evidence that points us to the problem being in that phonological or speech processing domain of language.
Interesting. So what do you think causes dyslexia?
Causes, that's an interesting word, isn't it? I mean, yes. Because there's different sorts of causes. So obviously biology is important. We've known for many years dyslexia runs in families. We know something about the genes that are associated with dyslexia and also something about brain development in dyslexia. So that's biological. The environment's also important, and particularly good teaching. I mean, good teaching can help a dyslexic child have much less of a severe difficulty than will poor teaching. But I guess from my perspective, I think the really important level of explanation we have to look for is cognitive explanations. That is, we have to look for explanations in the domain of processing of language, because it's only currently at that level that we can actually develop interventions. So if we can say what's wrong cognitively, we can say we've got to support the child in developing that process, and then it will help their reading and spelling.
So that is environmental, isn't it? Which takes me back. You said there's a genetic link. How do you distinguish between what you think is a genetic link, inheritance in other words, from the fact that in a family environment, people are talking to each other in different ways? Let's say there is a dyslexic parent who, in a sense, is using sounds in a particular way. Might that not be straight environmental? Because let's say I'm talking or using sounds in a particular way, misunderstanding things or whatever, and I pass that on to my child unknowingly in the environment, in which case it wouldn't be a genetic link. How do you distinguish between those?
Well, this is a complex issue. First of all, we know from twin studies that the phonological skills that are weak in dyslexia are highly heritable.
Find one twin who is being brought up in a different surroundings from the other one, and yet they both have a sort of equal level of phonological dysfunction.
That's one type of evidence. But what you're talking about is what I would think of as gene-environment correlation, which, of course, is that if you are a dyslexic parent, you're not only passing on your genes to your child, but you're also passing on an environment which is associated with your genes. And we refer to that as kind of passive gene-environment interaction. So if a parent never does any reading, and many adults with dyslexia, you know, hate reading, then obviously you don't see the model of reading in the environment. And similarly, once a child itself, him or herself, has some problems, they will turn away from reading. So they will actively avoid environments which help them with reading. So it's a multiplier. I don't think it's just environmental, though, because once you start saying it's just environmental, you can start saying, oh, well, it's all down to poor schooling, or it's all down to poor teaching, or it's all down to poor parenting. But it really is much more complex than that. We have to recognise there is a risk. It's a family-related risk, but we have to realise it's transmitted through the learning environment, and we can change that learning environment.
Yes, let's go back to the point you made about cognitive development. So this is the idea that we have to help children, because we're up the phonological end of things before the graphic ones, before the signs on the page. So how should we be helping children in this cognitive correlation between hearing words and understanding them?
First of all, we should help all children with literacy development, clearly. But for children who are at risk of dyslexia, and I would count two groups as being at very significant risk. One group would be a group who have a dyslexic parent, and another group would be a group who have a spoken language difficulty. And both of those kids are really at risk of developing significant reading problems. What we need to do is make sure that at the point they go to school, when they're getting formal reading instruction, they're kind of ready to learn. Their spoken language skills must be good. So in the preschool years, parents have got to do a lot of language. They've got to share books. They've got to do reading. They've got to do language games. They've got to do a lot of talking to their kids. So that's the first thing.
Nursery rhymes are good.
Teaching vocabulary is very good. Books that asking questions about the pictures, enriching the vocabulary. Lots of kids who are not at risk of dyslexia, I mean, you do this anyway and they pick it up, but you need to do just a little bit more, a little bit more emphasis for kids who are at risk. The other two components is sounds. So we've got to tune up their phonological system.
I say again, nursery rhymes, patty cake, baker's man. It repeats the sound, doesn't it? Or humpty dumpty, all those old nursery rhymes. They've got a lot of repetition in them.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a very good way in. We need to add on to that, learning about the individual sound. So I spy, but not I spy something beginning with T, but I spy something beginning with T. They're great. Also, teach them the letters. Teach them to name the letters. Teach them to write the letters. And I would say the numbers as well, because any symbol has got to be linked to a phonological label, and anyone who's got poor phonology will have difficulties also with numbers. But don't think, as a parent, you have to teach your child to read before they go to school. I think we should have lots of language-based work which hones the development of the knowledge of the letters and of the sounds of words.
Now, why is there a controversy about dyslexia? I mean, as we said at the top of the programme, some people are claiming in some way or another it is a gift. I shouldn't say that in a kind of pejorative way, that in that film there were pictures of Einstein who it's claimed was dyslexic. So almost they were saying, you know, why not buy yourself some dyslexic sperm? I'm not using the terminology properly here. And then who knows, your child might turn out to be Einstein. What do you say to that?
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, I don't for a minute doubt that you can be dyslexic and you can be gifted. And that's clearly true from people who self-identify, you know, entrepreneurs like Richard Branson, often quoted alongside the people that you've already mentioned from historical sources. But the issue here is whether dyslexia causes that giftedness or whether we have two different entities that just happen to co-occur in one person. And I would say the latter is the case. We don't have any evidence that being dyslexic is a direct cause of giftedness.
Or that they're conjoined. I mean, there's one argument saying, oh, well, look, dyslexics are gifted. It's just that we've suppressed their giftedness because we've made it pathological. We've said, oh, well, there's a dyslexic, let's put him or her in the corner. Whereas what we should have said is, oh, this is an extraordinary child, that they're dyslexic, and look at them, look at what they're doing with the Lego there. They're building an incredible Lego castle. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've heard mm-hmm. this argument. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what we've done is misread the signs and then, as it were, made them less clever than they are.
Well, we must agree there's lots of individual differences in the strengths and difficulties children and people have. You know, I'm pretty terrible at music, for instance. It turns out it doesn't really matter because it's not crucial to the education system in which we live and are brought up. But we also know about expertise, otherwise known as giftedness, that you need to do huge amounts of practice. And for a child who is choosing not to read and not to choose any, to do any literary pursuits, of course, they might spend much more time building Lego, drawing, constructing things, playing football or whatever. And so they may become expert. I think my own view is, though, you can't become gifted unless you have some innate talent, and you can't become dyslexic unless you have an innate disposition. Those two sets of dispositions can co-occur.
So let's imagine there are parents or grandparents or people bringing up children, looking after children in any way at all. And let's say these children are under five, so they're sort of pre-literate or just coming into the literate world. Mm-hmm. How might that person think, ooh, have I got a, am I looking at a dyslexic child here? Because, as I say, most people think it's about the reading and writing, and they may not, they may be hearing this from you for the first time, that actually it's up the listening and speaking end.
Well, I think that's a real problem, and there isn't widespread understanding of what you would look for in those early years. And I think what you'd want to look for actually is some slow acquisition of speech and or other language skills like grammar. The problem is that particularly for parents who are first parents, they don't really have any benchmarks. So often it's easier to identify a second child who's perhaps not developing as quickly in relation to language and literacy than a firstborn child. So that becomes a problem. I think also if the child is particularly gifted with visual motor skills, then it's easier to see the discrepancy for parents, whereas not all dyslexic kids are good at those visual motor tasks, and they may have a more even pattern of development. And so their problems might not actually really come to the surface until they go to school, and then they can't learn to read. And so then the focus is on that. What I think the kind of giftedness movement, one very important thing that they, I think, are bringing to our attention is that if you're dyslexic, teachers and parents need to be encouraging their kids to build on their strengths, because being good at something is an incredible protective influence. It's an incredible support for your resilience against what's actually quite a handicap in our education system.
Right. So you've taken us through into education, sort of 4 to 6 year olds. Let's imagine we've got a teacher in front of us and they think there's a child or a couple of children in the class and they really are not getting this stuff. So they're getting half an hour phonics instruction a day, systematic synthetic phonics, which is correlating the visual with the oral, with mm-hmm. what they can hear. But there's this child not picking it up. What should the teacher do?
Well, I think the first thing the teacher needs to do is be making fairly regular observations of that child. And there are various ways of monitoring a child's progression through phonics and culminating in, I guess, a phonics screening at the end of year one. So what a teacher should be doing is looking at how they're responding. Don't get too alarmed initially. If they're responding slowly, put in more help with phonics in recognition of the fact that it's not laziness, it is actually a difficulty. It might be that there's a small group giving some additional support. But I think if you go right through to the end of year one and you really are struggling behind, you then do need to have more specialist support put in. Equally, the teacher can, I think, try to employ other resources, because that child mustn't miss out on the rest of the curriculum. And of course, you might say, well, the curriculum early on is pretty much around language and literacy. That's right. Make sure the child, though, can access the language of books, be that through a volunteer reading with that child or a parent reading with that child. So the child is not going to start to also have difficulties, not only with the decoding aspects of reading, but also with the vocabulary that you learn through books, the language that you learn through group books. Because if you're not careful, by the time you solve the phonics problem, you will end up with a problem with reading comprehension.
So we've got to keep both things going at the same time.
I think we do.
And up the level for that child who we might describe, I know it's an emotive word, at risk. So that child who's at risk of being dyslexic, or may actually be that, if we're going to give mm-hmm. the category, mm-hmm. We've got to up both. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's right. You've got to give them some special attention to develop their phonic-based skills, reading and writing, the two things, using multisensory techniques, probably more individualised than in the mainstream. But then you've also got to make sure that perhaps you can't get it all done in the school day, but someone is also working, helping them with their language, so you don't get a decline in vocabulary in the school years, which we often see in dyslexia.
And roughly how many children are we talking about, a sort of percentage of the population? So in a school of 200 children, it's a pretty small school, 400 children, how many might we describe as dyslexic?
Well, I think that's tricky because the how many you get depends on where you put the cutoff. But I used to say, in terms of severe dyslexia, you could expect one in every classroom.
One in every classroom?
I think you could have as many as one in every classroom, yeah. And then some of those would have a specific dyslexic difficulty, and some would have a dyslexic difficulty that's a consequence of having a spoken language problem. So, and then around that, kids with dyslexic traits who are not so severely affected, you might have 3 and 4 in every classroom. So I think
huge.
It is a huge problem. And I think schools need to think about that when they think about their school policy. Not everybody can have individualised help, but we have to know who's the severe one, who are the severe ones who are not making progress. They need the individualised help. We then need to look at the support that's being given and how it's being delivered. It can be a real problem in secondary school when there's also a curriculum to deliver. But I think schools need to stand back and really examine the policy that they have for supporting kids with dyslexia and other special needs.
It's quite interesting because we've got dyslexia. It's there in the common parlance. Everyone hears about it. Let's just have a little look at the word, the dis bit, which we obviously hear in front of disappoint and disappear and so on. That's got quite a sort of negative connotation, hasn't it? It's the idea that it's bad or difficult. It's a way of negativizing a word, isn't it? And then the lexis bit does mean word, which is taken on to mean reading. Is dyslexia agreed? Is it agreed term across education?
No, it's not at all an agreed term. And actually, it's partly because it's a sort of medical sounding term that I think there has been controversy about its use. The current use...
Are you okay about it?
I'm okay about it. I think it's really quite important. I think specific learning difficulty, specific learning disorder are the alternatives. And in a way, I don't bother so much about what the name is, but I do think it should be named. And I think a lot of people who bother about the name are actually bothered about the diagnosis. So it's a different way of expressing that actually dyslexia doesn't exist.
I've heard people say it's a myth.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, why do they say that and what do you say to them?
Well, I think they think it's a myth because they're uncomfortable with the fact that reading skills are normally distributed in the population. So you have good readers and you have poor readers. And there's no agreement as where you put off the cutoff to say you've got dyslexia as opposed to not having dyslexia. I think they're uncomfortable with that. They want it to be something like chickenpox, where you can say, I can see those spots, that is chickenpox. So it's not different in the way chickenpox is, but it is much more like other dimensions like obesity, for instance. So obesity is just really overweight.
But it's severe. But so we have severe. These words, grave, severe. Yeah. They help us think that it's more of an issue. I mean,
exactly.
Those words. Those
and if you don't treat it, you end up having diabetes or a heart attack or you know, premature death. So if we don't label things, no one's aware of them and they don't get any intervention. Then it is the responsibility of our education system to make sure that everyone with dyslexia has the intervention and support they need. Saying it's a myth doesn't actually help, because if it's a myth, then the education system can completely deny it, which I would argue is happening.
Really? You'd say as much as that? You're saying the education system is denying it?
Well, I think that over time...
Denying that
we've
it
seen,
exists.
Well, I think, well, many local authorities won't use the term. Many local...
Academy trusts? Because now it's divided in the country.
Well, I think some academy trusts use it and some do not. Yeah. So, but there's no consensus. And that's really what we need. We're never going to agree about this, because historically, you go back right to 1896 when Pringle Morgan reported the first case, it's gone in and out of fashion. Government put in resources and then they take them away. It gets put back in. In 2009, Sir Jim Rose did a review of dyslexia, its nature, what you do about it in the education system. It was a really evidence-based report. Funding came behind it to train specialist teachers. And then we have, you know, change in policy, and you get all of that now, you know, retrenchment in a way.
And was that completely put to one side?
Well, I think, you know, obviously some of the people who are trained are still in schools and they're still doing their best to do their bit. But if you have no resources, then you can't really do your bit, because you have to be concentrating on everyone in the classroom. So it is a really significant issue, I think. And so I understand why people debate the concept. But if you're a scientist, you can't deny the concept, because it does exist. And we know that those children don't respond to normal classroom intervention and they need something else.
Have you experienced it in your family?
I have experienced in my family, both as a sibling and as a mother. So my brother was severely dyslexic. We're going back to the 60s now. He's my younger brother. My mother was just told, because he was failing to learn to read, well, he's not as bright as his sister.
Interesting. Straight away, it's bright, not as clever. So there is a correlation made by teachers or whoever. I'm not blaming teachers, but they say, oh, well, look, he's not writing, he's not reading properly, therefore not as clever. So it's seen as a sort of global thing attached to intelligence, whatever that is.
Exactly. And then it becomes internalised in the child and they have a very poor academic self-concept. Then they start skiving from school. Then they start getting into trouble, or they start internalising, becoming depressed, anxious. And I think there are significant mental health effects. But we don't know enough about that yet. We don't know. We haven't got the evidence, but we need to search for it.
And then you said as a mother as well. Sorry, I don't want to push you. What did you notice with your own child?
Well, first of all, I was, of course, looking out for it. And it's quite an interesting story, because we did lots of the early years stuff that I mentioned, you know, sound games, reading, you know, why wouldn't I, teaching him his letters? Although he didn't really want to learn them, I have to say. It's not that easy, because many kids who've got those difficulties actually don't want to do those things.
Yes.
So you've got to kind of be persistent. And we used to, you know, set sort of 10 minutes, that's all we're doing. So we don't kind of go over the top, because at the end of the day, you're a parent, you're not a teacher.
Magnet letters on the fridge, that sort of thing.
But as a psychologist, when I was doing an assessment of a six-year-old, and I heard myself saying to the parents, well, if I was you, I would now not be waiting any longer. I would be taking some action and getting some intervention. And then I thought about it. I thought, goodness, James is six now. We ought to be doing something. And we started to teach him. I mean, every morning we used to just do reading and spelling. And of course, between the age of six and transfer to secondary school, if you just do 15 minutes a day, you'll be able to give your child much more intervention than any school system will ever give that child.
And that 15 minutes a day would be reading, sharing books, playing with letters, saying what letter do you think
initially
that is?
It was a lot of reading, and then but later, I mean, once he got off with reading, it was really about writing, teaching spellings, teaching spelling patterns, teaching how, you know, the grammatical constructions in language. So it's more about the writing side, because that's more of a challenge than reading. Because once you get off with reading, you can use, if you've got reasonable language, you can use context, you can, you know, you can, we use the term bootstrap, but you can support your phonics by using language. For spelling, you can't do that. You've got to know the letter-by-letter sequence.
Yes, but that's, of course, when we do hit the irregularities of English.
Exactly.
So, you know, going all the way back to my bird, if the child writes B-E-R-D, they are, quotes, right, because it does, reading the sounds there, E-R usually is er, so bird, burned, er, so there we are, it's bird, but I'm wrong. And then you tell me I'm wrong, and you say, no, it's B-I-R-D, and I'm going, oh, no, it's wrong.
Yes, I
get fed up. Well, I'm thinking of my own kids,
I think James had insight into that, because what he used to say to me was, I mean, I was teaching the sound chunks, like er says erd, I-R, But when we got to longer words, he'd say, Mum, don't tell me about the sounds. I don't want to know about the sounds. I'm just trying to learn the letters. And he was trying to use his visual memory, because actually he found the sound so hard.
So you've got a word like controversy or miscellany.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a nightmare, isn't it?
It is a nightmare. Yeah, yeah. Well, there's all the verbal short-term memory, and there's the segmenting the sounds, and there's remembering the spellings. Yes, it is a nightmare.
Yes.
But fortunately, we now have technology.
Go on.
Well, I mean, we've had spelling checkers forever, and of course dyslexic people don't really like them, because they give you all sorts of alternatives and you may not be able to distinguish between which one you want to choose. But obviously what we can do now is use voice recognition software to help people write what they want to write. And I think we should be bringing that in much earlier in schools for kids who really are struggling. I mean, yes,
some people think that's cheating.
Well, it's not cheating, because it's not an equal playing field anyway.
Right.
You might say you're being cheated if you end up dyslexic in our education system.
On that note, Professor Maggie Snowling, thank you very much indeed.